You're listening to Radio Hangar Aviation Talk, powered by AI, fueled by passion. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar. Glad you're here today because I want to talk about somebody we all think we know, Amelia Earhart. And I mean really talk about her. Not the movie version, not the postage stamp version, the pilot. Because here's the thing. Somewhere along the way, Amelia Earhart became more famous for disappearing than for flying. And that's a shame. That is a real shame, because the woman could fly. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's go back to the beginning. Not 1937, not the last flight, the first one. Amelia Mary Earhart, born July 24, 1897, in Atchison, Kansas. And if you're picturing some delicate flower who stumbled into aviation by accident, you've got the wrong person entirely. This was a kid who built a homemade roller coaster off the roof of her family's tool shed. She was 7 years old. The thing actually worked. She came off it covered in dirt with her dress torn and said it felt just like flying. Now here's where it gets interesting. She didn't catch the flying bug the way most of us did. She was working as a nurse's aide in Toronto during the First World War, tending to wounded soldiers, and she went to an air show at the Canadian National Exhibition. 1918, a pilot in a Curtiss, Jenny, spotted her standing on the field and decided to buzz her, dove right at her, and she didn't flinch, she just stood there, while that Jenny roared over her head. She said later that she felt like that airplane was speaking to her. A couple years later, December of 1920, she was at a stunt flying exhibition at Daugherty Field in Long Beach, California. Her father paid a barnstormer named Frank Hawks $10 to take her up for a ride. 10 bucks. That was real money back then. They went up in an open cockpit biplane, and the moment they cleared the field and she could see the Hollywood sign and the Pacific Ocean at the same time, she said she knew she had to fly. 6 months later, she started taking lessons. Her instructor was a woman named Anita Snook, Nata, they called her. One of the first women to graduate from the Curtiss School of Aviation. And she was flying a Curtiss Jenny, a beat-up, oil-leaking, cantankerous Jenny. Earhart loved every second of it. She worked every odd job you can imagine to pay for those lessons. Truck driver, photographer, telephone company clerk. She bought her first airplane 6 months into training, a bright yellow Kinner Airster biplane. She called it the Canary. That little airplane had a 60-horsepower Kinner engine that sounded like a sewing machine with ambitions. Three-cylinder radial, it overheated if you looked at it wrong, but she flew it. She flew it hard. And on October 22, 1922, she took the Canary up to 14,000 feet and set the women's altitude record. She was 25 years old and had been flying for barely a year. Now let me pause right here, because this is where the myth machine starts to crank up. In 1928, Amelia Earhart became the first woman to cross the Atlantic by airplane, and that's true. But what gets lost in the retelling is that she didn't fly the airplane, she was a passenger. The pilots were Wilmer Stoltz and Lou Gordon, flying a Fokker F-7 trimotor floatplane called Friendship. Earhart sat in the back with a logbook, and she hated it. She was honest about it. She told reporters afterward that she was just baggage, like a sack of potatoes, she said. She knew she'd been chosen partly because she looked good in photographs and partly because the project's organizer, a publisher named George Putnam, wanted a marketable personality. But here's what matters. She didn't let that define her. She didn't cash the check and go home. She got angry. She got motivated. She decided she was going to cross that ocean for real, flying the airplane herself, and 4 years later she did, May 20th, 1932. She took off from Harbor Grace, Newfoundland, in a Lockheed Vega 5B red and gold. Single-engine Pratt & Whitney Wasp, 450 horsepower. That Wasp was a beast of an engine, reliable, smooth, but she was going to ask a lot of it. The plan was to fly nonstop to Paris, like Lindbergh, same distance, same ocean, same bed against the weather. It didn't go as planned. About 4 hours in, flying through the night over the open Atlantic, she hit a massive storm front, rain and ice. The altimeter failed. Think about that for a second. You're over the North Atlantic in the dark. No GPS, no autopilot, no moving map, and now you don't know how high you are. The ice built up on the wings of that Vega so fast and so heavy that the airplane went into a spin. She fell 3,000 feet before she pulled it out. 3,000 feet in a spin over the black Atlantic Ocean at night. She recovered by feel, by instinct, by the sound of the wind on the airframe and the pressure in her seat. Then the exhaust manifold cracked. She could see flames licking along the engine cowling through a vibrating weld seam. She was watching fire on her only engine over the middle of the ocean, and she kept going. She never made Paris. The weather and the mechanical problems forced her to divert. She landed in a farmer's pasture in Londonderry, Northern Ireland, after 15 hours and 18 minutes alone over the Atlantic. When the farmer walked up to the airplane, she asked him where she was. He told her. She'd crossed the ocean. Now that is a pilot. Pull up a chair for this next part because I think it's the most important thing about Amelia Earhart that nobody ever talks about. She was a pretty good stick and rudder pilot, but she wasn't the best of her era. And she would have told you that herself. There were women flying in the 1920s and 30s who were arguably better pure aviators. Louise Thaden, Jacqueline Cochran, Ruth Nichols, Pancho Barnes, who could outfly most of the men at any airfield in America. What made Earhart extraordinary wasn't that she was the best pilot in the sky. It was that she understood something the others didn't. Aviation needed a public face. It needed someone who could make ordinary people believe that flying was safe, that flying was accessible, that flying was the future. And she made herself into that person. She wrote best-selling books. She designed a clothing line. She gave lectures to packed auditoriums. She took Eleanor Roosevelt on a nighttime flight over Washington, D.C., and the First Lady loved it so much, she started the process of getting her own pilot's license. Earhart was doing something that we'd call advocacy today. She was building the culture around flying. Every time she climbed into a cockpit, she wasn't just proving that women could fly, she was proving that anyone could fly, and that mattered. In the 1930s, when most Americans had never been inside an airplane, that mattered enormously. She also pushed hard for what we'd now call pilot professionalism. She was one of the founding members of a group called the 99s, an international organization of women pilots, named for the 99 women who showed up at the first meeting in 1929. That organization still exists today, still active, still supporting women in aviation. Now, the last flight. I know you're waiting for it. Everybody always wants to talk about the last flight. July 2, 1937, she and her navigator, Fred Noonan, were attempting to fly around the world at the equator. They'd already covered about 22,000 miles. They were on one of the last legs, Lei Ie, New Guinea, to Howland Island, a tiny speck in the Central Pacific, less than a mile long. Finding it was like finding a specific grain of sand on a beach from 2,500 miles away. They were flying a Lockheed Electra 10E twin Pratt and Whitney Wasp Jr. engines, a good airplane, a capable airplane, but the navigation challenge was immense. They had celestial navigation and radio direction finding. That was it. The United States Coast Guard cutter Itasca was stationed off Howland Island to serve as a radio beacon, but there were problems. Frequency confusion. Earhart and the Itasca were apparently never on the same page about which frequencies they'd use for direction finding. Her radio transmissions came in strong but brief. She couldn't hear their replies, or maybe she could but couldn't get a bearing from them. Her last confirmed radio transmission was at 8:43 in the morning local time. She reported they were flying on the line of position 157-337 running north and south. She said they were running low on fuel, and then silence. The Navy launched the largest search and rescue operation in its history up to that point. Battleships, destroyers, aircraft, they covered 250,000 square miles of open ocean. They found nothing. And that's where the myth really takes over, doesn't it? The theories crashed and sank, landed on a reef at an uninhabited island called Nikumaroro, captured by the Japanese. Living secretly under an assumed name in New Jersey of all places. The most likely answer is the simplest one and the saddest one. They ran out of fuel. They went into the Pacific. The ocean is enormous and it keeps its secrets, but let me tell you what bothers me about how we remember this. We've turned Amelia Earhart into a mystery instead of a pilot. Kids learn about the disappearance in school. They learn about theories and conspiracies. They don't learn about the cracked exhaust manifold over the Atlantic. They don't learn about the spin recovery and icing conditions at night. They don't learn that she hand-propped the canary in Kansas wheat fields, or that she could dead reckon across a continent with a compass and a clock. We turned a pilot into a ghost story, and I think if she were here, she'd be furious about that. She left behind a letter to her husband, George Putnam, written before the world flight, she wrote, and I'm paraphrasing here. She said, "Please know that I am quite aware of the hazards. I want to do it because I want to do it. Women must try to do things as men have tried. When they fail, their failure must be but a challenge to others. That's not a mystery. That's a pilot's credo." You know what I think about sometimes? I think about her sitting in that Lockheed Vega over the North Atlantic, watching fire on the cowling, altimeter dead, and choosing to keep going. That's not mythology. That's airmanship. That's the same thing every pilot since has done when the weather closes in and the alternator quits and you've got to find the field. You fly the airplane. Amelia Earhart flew the airplane. That's her legacy. Not the disappearance. The flying, the material for today's segment, draws on the work of several excellent sources. Susan Butler's biography, East to the Dawn, is probably the most thoroughly researched account of Earhart's life. The 99's organization maintains outstanding historical archives. The Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum has done excellent work documenting her aircraft and career. And for the details of the last flight, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, known as TIGAR, has published decades of research worth reading, whether you agree with their conclusions or not. As always, Radio Hangar is an AI-generated program produced by pilots who care about getting the history right. If you want to learn more or see the source material behind today's show, head over to radiohangar.com. I'm Tail Dragger. Go read about the real Amelia Earhart, not the mystery, the pilot fly. Safe out there, Radio Hangar. Keep the blue side up.